Okay, so we've heard from various disciplines about plumes and upwellings. And of course, seismology provides a means of at least imaging or trying to image what we actually see in what shapes and forms these upwellings might actually look like. So I'm going to go through, lead you through some approaches, which seismological approaches that may actually be useful for this purpose, and actually try to show what the issues are. So, of course, if we want to look at plumes, plumes are little things, like we discussed this morning. So, the best approaches would be to actually be able to image them in a very local fashion. So, I'll talk a little bit about what local tomography can do. Complementary to this, because as you'll see, local tomography has some problems right now. People have devised other local methodologies based on the use of converted phases and so-called receiver functions. And then I'll switch on to things that, first of all, I know better myself, and also which enable us to have some constraints on more of the large scale features that still should be pretty important to constrain with any dynamical model. And finally, maybe say a few words about forward modeling, which is the next step. So I borrowed this slide from a paper by Shen et al, which actually is not really intended to criticize their work, but which shows the problem with local tomography. The problem with local tomography is you're sitting, for example, here in Iceland, you're sitting on the island and you're trying to image what is going on under the island by using waves that are coming from large distances. And they all come up more or less parallel to each other, so that, in fact, there is no way you can really resolve very well with such a small aperture what the depth and lateral extent of the structure is. And this is already maybe a better case than what we typically would do in global tomography, where in global tomography you'd have just one station, one or two stations you'd be using on this island. But here, basically, all you can say is, you're going to be able to retrieve is the average structure in this depth range in the upper mantle. You're not going to be able to really resolve how deep it goes, nor, excuse me? Oh, this is because they've been looking at the transition zone thickness. I'll tell you. I'm just showing this slide to illustrate the ray pass, okay, that you have in this kind of geometry. In order to resolve structures, you need to have crossing rays in a particular structure, and no way you can get it. In order to be able to do this, you really need a much larger aperture array, an array that would cover from continent to continent, really, to then be able to have crossing paths in this region coming from many different directions. Okay, so that's one limitation. The other limitation is, of course, that you're limited by the distribution of sources, so you may not also be able to go all around. But anyway, this is really the problem. Most of the plumes that we want to model are on island or on islands, and so, and typically, until we actually get to having large-scale ocean bottom arrays, we're not going to be able to get away or get rid of this problem of the geometry. So anyway, I mean, there are ways to try to address this. This is a model by Richard Allen and others of the Iceland plume. And in order to try and improve resolution, what he's done here is he's added to the body waves, which are the main contributors to mapping the plumes, he's added some surface wave data, which allow him to constrain the structure laterally in the first 200 kilometers, the current 100 kilometer depth. But still, the picture is somewhat indeterminate in terms of how deep this goes and how wide the plume is. So people have been trying to come up with other sort of ideas about how to get around this. And One which relies very heavily on what we know about the properties of the discontinuities in the upper mantle is to take advantage of the presumed Clapeyron slopes of the 400 and 600 kilometer discontinuities. And there again, the reasoning goes like this, is that if we assume that the 400 has a positive Clapeyron slope, which I think we know, we would agree on at least for this one, and the 600 has a negative Clapeyron slope, and if we assume that we know the slopes pretty well, you would expect if you have a plume, a narrow plume coming from a thermal boundary layer in the lower mantle to appear to uplift the 660 kilometer discontinuity and to downwarp the 400 kilometer discontinuity very locally. Okay, so you would see a thinning of the transition zone width under the plume, but it would be very localized. You would not see it very far away from the center. Whereas if you have another type of origin from the for the plume, say it comes from a boundary layer here at the 600 kilometer discontinuity, then what you would expect a warping of this discontinuity, but the 660 would stay flat. So you would also see a somewhat different signature on the on the thickness of the transition zone. And finally, if you have some thermal coupling between the lower mantle and the upper mantle, and you have a plume originating in the upper mantle as a consequence of that, you would expect a short wavelength warping of the 400 kilometers continuity, but a very smooth long wavelength one of the 600. So these are sort of basic ideas which rely on some relatively strong assumptions. And if you do this, well, based on this, Chen et al. In specifically concluded that the Iceland plume must come from deep in the deeper than the 600 kilometer discontinuity. They looked at so-called receiver function converted phases from the 660 and 410 kilometer discontinuity, and then looked at what it what the depths were and what the depth difference, which gives you the thickness of the transition zone, which they corrected for some tomographic model, some volumetric heterogeneity, and they find that here are several cross sections. One is north of Iceland, so north of the plume, and doesn't show much variation in longitude. Whereas if you go right across the plume at the second cross section there, you see this localized thinning of the transition zone. And then you can see that also going from north to south. And from this, they inferred that they see a localized thinning of the transition zone, and therefore that the plume must come from lower mantle. So this is the kind of reasoning that goes into this type of study. More recently, this is a study by a German group who used similar approaches under Hawaii, and found also that there is a significant thinning of the transition zone, but it's actually even larger. They find here a thinning compared to around other places around Hawaii. In this southwestern part of Hawaii, they find a thinning by 50 kilometers or something like that, which they translated into a 300 degree excess plume temperature. What I would like to keep from this picture is that, well, of course, they don't have very good coverage. And but what's remarkable is that the region of thinning, if indeed we can interpret it in terms of that's where the plume conduit is actually offset to the south of Hawaii, and we don't really know from this analysis how far south really the center is. Okay, so now we've seen this. Now let's go to global. So I said a few words about the problems with local tomography and how We really would need much larger aperture arrays to address the problem. So what happens at the global scale? So at the global scale, we now have... Yes? Yes.
You have the vertical velocity. The seismic velocity varies from the center of the arc element to the outside. How do you take the cross the boundary definition? There's boundary change, but also depending upon the rate path.
Yeah, so in, what you're saying is there's... Right. What you're saying is there's some trade-offs between volumetric variations and I mean that the thickness thinning contains some signal from just the volumetric heterogeneity. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I think
yes. Well, I mean it's not my work. I'm just saying. I'm saying you know there are some very strong assumptions made there on the interpretation of these things. But you're right. I mean, an important component is that in addition to just the you know the hypothetical bending of the discontinuities, you may have a strong heterogeneity in velocity just from the temperature, which you know if you don't correct for it precisely, you
can't.
You can't.
Can you show the previous figure because there was a very there's this greater than 26 seconds next to the less than there's more yellow triangles than the blue ones, but the fact that the blue ones show up, it sort of gives you a pause, or at least would give me a pause.
Well, yes. I mean, on average, though, most of the blue is on this side, right? And you can see a gradient in general, except for this one point. So, I think we could look at in detail at their actual record sections to see where that is coming from, if you're interested, but I don't have that here. Okay, so. Now we go to the global scale, and this model, of course, if it was presented by the Princeton group, they would go in great detail as to, you know, which plume do we map, how far deep, etc. I'm a skeptic of this model, and I'm going to tell you why. So I just want to be upfront with this, to be honest, but okay, so we at the global scale, we have essentially the same problem as at the local scale. Most of the plumes are on islands, and most islands have only one or two global stations, and they are well separated from other stations by thousands of kilometers. So when you do tomography using body waves such as P and PP waves, you will still have the same problem that you will have very much trouble resolving in depth anything in the upper mantle, essentially, unless you add other types of data. And there's another problem in addition to that is that the core mantle boundary, the P waves also don't have that much resolution of the core mantle boundary, because as you approach the core mantle boundary, you start needing to include other types of phases, diffracted phases that and reflected phases on the core mantle boundary that really have some sensitivity. So I went back, well anyway, this Adam showed this on Monday already, and you know I'll just I agree with the point he made is that this model is presented as a breakthrough because of a theoretical approach, but in fact it's really the problem is not the theoretical approach, because if you compare the standard sort of approach, which is ray theory applied to inverting these data, and the so-called banana donut one, there is really not much difference between these models except in the amplitude of some of these yellow or red dots, which are somewhat stronger in this finite frequency kernel model. But there's other ways, I mean, whether this is due to the theory is not obvious because of the sampling issue. The sampling issue introduces the need to damp the models, and when you use different kernels for the inversion, the damping schemes will have to be different, and so attaching too much importance to amplitude here versus here at this point, I think, is unwarranted. So I've gone back to actually look at how this model at least at the base of the mantle, looks differently from other models that were previously published. I put here an S velocity model. This is our Berkeley model, just for comparisons. All the other ones are P models. And one, this is a Karasam and van der Hilst. This is a Japanese model, 98, and it represents an average actually over large depths, or the last 1,000 kilometers of the mantle, whereas these two are just maps. But as you can see, actually these models are pretty similar, in particular as far as the red regions go. You might even say, if you look at this Tokyo model, that it picks up more plumes than the Princeton model, if you were to take that at face value. So again, I mean, this is interpreting this in terms of actual plumes that you image with depths is really, I mean, maybe this is what it is, but it's still something that needs to be sort of really verified and is left for the future to determine whether they're really right. Just as we had this thing about subduction zones that, as Diane showed, that you had these pictures of the Farallon slab going all the way through the mantle, and at the time that picture was first presented, then issue was settled as to whether subduction zones do penetrate or do not penetrate into the lower mantle. The future showed that, in fact, it's not that clear, because this was a very specific cross-section that they were showing.
Barbara, has anybody done, is it possible, make a synthetic Earth with no features in the lower mantle except for a single plume that it has is constructed from a geodynamic model of a plume like Louise was showing, and goes from the core mantle boundary up, and maybe it does something as it goes through the 660 or something like that, it comes up, and then sort of use mineral physics to estimate what its velocity properties would be, and then
compute
what it should look like.
Well, you can do it today. But if you were to do it today and were impatient to get the results, you would have to do it with an approximate theoretical approach, okay? Which again, it sort of becomes circular
what
a little bit.
What aspect of it is problematic?
Well, I mean, if you put in just ray theory, say, and compute your seismograms using ray theory, and if you get back your model, you may think, well, that's fine, I can resolve this. But in fact, that's where the theoretical assumptions will start to, I think we have to do this with an exact kind of formalism for the wave propagation, okay, before we... Yes, well, okay, so that's why I said if you're impatient. If you're patient, I think we're going to be able to do this in a couple of years. The reason why we have the SEM code, and it's going to higher and higher frequencies, and you can almost do everything with it if you have the Earth simulator, but it still takes a while. And so if you want to process thousands and thousands of seismograms, it's just beyond our capabilities. But I think in a couple of years we'll be able to do this test and also test all the global models that are done using longer period waves, waveforms, etc., in a much more exact manner. You'll be able to compute really exact seismograms that take into account all of the 3D effects.
That's a very good suggestion.
Yeah, no, it is. I think we want to do this. I just think it's...
Could do it, and a bunch of us are trying to convince him to do it.
Well...
But the reason he won't do it is the following. He'll make enemies of all the tomographers in the world. He'll generate this exact model and give it to you guys
No,
and
I,
see what you can get out of it, and he thinks that you will not like.
Well, no, I don't. I think that's the wrong type of excuse. I think the problem is more practical, is that if you were to compute the how many thousands of waveforms do you use in your models?
Well, no, tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands, you know, hundreds of earthquakes. No, it's still going to take him years to do the computation.
No, he's actually sized out this problem, and you can make a realistic test with a finite amount of money and a finite amount of time.
Is that you, Trump, or you're
Yeah, Ritson.
You said Ritson.
I'm sorry, Trump.
Yeah, I mean, he's getting there, but it still takes a while to compute one earthquake. So that's what I'm saying. It's a couple of years.
Yeah. Well, we talked about that. But you guys tell him you want him to do it, he'll do it. And you won't hate him if you don't get the right answer at the end.
I don't think anybody's going to hate him. I'd like to do that myself. So.
Well, it's kind of a thankless job.
You know, wouldn't you be hated?
I'd like to look over his shoulder to look the way he's doing it.
No, you can't look.
No, I mean, I think you can.
If I give you the results, then you have to do it.
Yeah. You have a reason, she can do it herself. Yeah.
You agree, though, that in the absence of knowing what it should look like with the methods that you're using, that it's difficult to say anything about them with the data, with the model and data that you have.
I'm saying that there is enough uncertainty because of the coverage issue and how that plays into the inversion, that no matter what checkerboard test you're going to do now, because you're putting in not the exact wave propagation thing,
but that's true of these models, right?
Yeah. What is true of this?
I mean, they don't have the exact wave propagation.
No, that's right.
Right? Yeah. So the fact that you're saying that you couldn't see, we didn't know what to do with one in the absence of any other structure in the map, doesn't that make it seem like it's impossible?
Well, no, but the Princeton group claims that they have a better theory. On the other hand, their result shows that the theory doesn't make much difference.
Getting complicated.
Well, they also claimed they did some sensitivity tests, but I couldn't figure out exactly what it was.
Well, they did some sensitivity tests in the framework of their theory, so it's a little circular. That's all I'm trying to say. All these tests are circular now until we can do this particular experiment with the exact forward model.
Well, Barbara, would it become another difference between S and P? You get a very different impression looking at model, which I think is a model better result than anybody's P model, because you have SKS and SCS, but there's no analog in the P field.
Right.
So you have much better intrinsic coverage, and you get a different attribute of the P map. You don't get isolated during the quantum boom, you get these big structures. I think they're just missing.
They're missing the big structures because. Right. Yes. Well, that's right. I think that's a good point. I was going to get to it. No, but I mean, okay. So the comparison with this is that this is a global model that was derived from full seismograph waveforms that has many phases in it, but it is parameterized in a global fashion. So you will extract the long wavelength features. You will not get at the very small fluctuations with this approach anyway. Up till now, anyway. But
the same thing with P waves.
What is the same with P waves?
In terms of resolving the, basically you should get the big or large wavelength structures, P waves or short period.
But you don't have the right sampling. You don't have the right sampling because there's many more. As Stone said, there's not just S waves here. There's S diffracted, multiple SCS,
yeah.
Etc.
If you use PKP, you get a little bit more.
Well, okay. So let's look at the next slide. Okay. So this is from Carson and van der Hilst, where they used P and PP diffracted and PKP, and even there you can see. And this is checkerboard pattern. So for whatever it's worth. But you can clearly see that the southern hemisphere is very poorly resolved in P, and so is the mid-ocean basins. And so that's the issue we're struggling with.
So, Thorne, you're right. It looks like those little red patches they have are actually just
little places where they sample these great big fish.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right. Okay, so let's move to the long wavelength models then and see what they can tell us about the mantle and particular mantle upwellings. So this is our model, but many, you know, other models look similar. I mean, ours is an SH model, so it has some features in it that are specific the fact that the upper mantle is anisotropic. So for example, we have much faster velocity here in the 100 kilometer range than some other models due to this Pacific anomaly that Adam described. What I want to attract your attention to, of course, we see upwellings. Okay, so at this, in the upper mantle, we see the ridges and the back arcs. We follow them very nicely down to at least 200. Actually, you can still see them very well at 300 kilometers. And again, here, you know, we have perhaps slightly a depth resolution problem. 300 kilometers, 250, we can't say for sure. But what's striking is that somewhere here, in this depth range, going into the transition zone, there is really a shift of the pattern of the red blobs, shifts from the trenches to some features in more in the on the west, in the Pacific, Central Pacific. And then that continues further down, and you start picking up the subduction zones. And I want to talk about this a little bit more, the ridges and their depth extent. This is a map that we are still working on, but it's a student of mine, Mark Panning, who's developing a radial anisotropy model of the whole mantle. And the point of showing this is just radial anisotropy. So it's the difference between the speed of the propagation of SH and SV here at the depth of 250 kilometers, where you, in the velocity maps, you still see the ridges. And the point of this slide is to show that the ridge here, especially the East Pacific rise, is marked by a strong SH slower than SV, which is indicative of, can be interpreted in terms of flow, upward flow, vertical flow, or predominantly vertical flow. There's some signature also in the Atlantic Ocean. And what Mark did was to divide the ridge system into segments and look at the correlation of these anomalies in radial anisotropy with the spreading rate, and he gets quite a good correlation. There's some the outliers here are from the Baja California, so maybe we can ignore those. But the circles are from the Pacific Ocean, and the diamonds from the Atlantic Ocean, and you can see quite a good correlation between spreading rate and the anisotropic parameter, which sort of makes sense and gives credence to the interpretation of anisotropy in terms of indication of flow, right? Because you would expect that if you have a faster spreading rate, you will have a stronger amplitude of anisotropy. So there is potential. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that that you know we've been looking mostly at isotropic velocity so far in the mantle, but there is potential, even if those tomographic models don't give us all the details that we would like from just looking at the velocity. There are other markers, tomographic markers, such as anisotropy, and I will show later also attenuation, that can be used as complementary constraints and that have quite some potential. Now let's look at the lower mantle. This is a map view of the same model showing how in the long wavelength model things look through the lower mantle. But by the time you get to the base of the mantle, you see these very large features that are present in all the models. And if you try to trace them back up through the lower mantle, you see that they actually do narrow down, starting perhaps at around 500 kilometers above the core mantle boundary, and that you can sort of track them, but you sometimes kind of lose them a little bit, but they become much more narrow. There's a better way of looking at this. This is, looking at cross-sections. I chose this particular cross-section to kind of continue my point about what happens to the ridge system, especially in the Pacific, as a function of depth. So these are cross-sections in different directions, centered in this particular case on Samoa, showing the lower mantle here, and then above it the upper mantle. The scales have been somewhat saturated. In the upper mantle, you'd need a much larger scale to see the details. But this is to show two things. First of all, seems to be some continuity in the Pacific superplume all the way through the mantle. Don't know what happens here. I mean, I can't say for sure that this really continues through, but it's certainly adjacent to a feature that continues in the upper mantle. And then you see this very, very striking feature, which is that, in fact, the ridge is offset with respect to the center of the superplume. This is the CD east-west cross-section that you can see. You can see the subduction zone effect here on right here. And if you rotate it, you EF, you can see very, very much the same kind of thing. So there is, in these maps, sort of evidence for some continuity, whether or not this is through thermal coupling or through actual matter going through the 670 kilometer discontinuity is not possible to say, but at least it certainly is suggestive of at least local sort of connection or correspondence between the lower and the upper mantle, and this very special, you know, fact that that the ridges don't really have direct correspondence. And this has been seen in models for many years. Okay, so then another type of measurement or tomographic inversion, which can be done, is attenuation. And the reason for doing that is that while it's much more challenging to develop these models, attenuation has a very different dependence on temperature, water content, etc., than velocity. So the hope is you can actually get at seeing, with distinguishing the chemical from the thermal heterogeneity. These attenuation maps show the ridge system again in the uppermost mantle. And as you go into the transition zone, you essentially at present can resolve two regions of high attenuation, one centered in the Central Pacific and one centered in Africa, with a good correlation of the high attenuation zones with the hotspot distribution, which is also something that you see or that has been seen for many years between the lowest mantle velocity models and the hotspot distribution. This is shear Q, yes. This is the same model centered on Africa, just to show again this correlation with the ridge system at the uppermost mantle. And so, you know, this signature would be at first, to first order, interpreted in terms of a temperature signal. Okay, so one more view of now we don't have any Q in the lower mantle, but you can juxtapose velocity here again in the Pacific quote-unquote superstructure, do not call it superplume, and then the upper mantle, the Q, and again you see in the Q same thing where you have some correspondence with the velocity in the lowermost mantle quite directly above the superplume, and then a shift towards the ridges in the top of the mantle. And I would like to attract your attention to the fact that in this model shows that if you go through north-south through a section, Hawaii...
About 1,000 kilometers wide, right?
Excuse me?
About 1,000 kilometers wide.
What is?
The superplume.
The superplume here would be, okay, what is the scale? I mean, it would be about 3,000 to 5,000 kilometers wide. I mean, it depends, you know, where you cut off your red, you know, your color scale. Yeah. This is, okay, this model, this Q model is a degree 8 model. So degree 8 is like about resolution of 2,000 kilometers. But anyway, the point is Hawaii is not right. It doesn't seem from this model that really anything goes directly, anything strong goes directly from Hawaii all the way down to the Coromandel boundary. It looks more like Hawaii sort of connects with a superplume with something going on in the upper mantle, and whether or not it's, I like to put it in the asthenosphere, but maybe it's, maybe that's pushing it in the interpretation. This is the velocity, and the center of the superplume in velocity is somewhere here.
Yeah. Picture
that picture is Q? This is Q, yes, okay. This is Q. So it's smeared out because it's a lower degree resolution. Another point to make about Q and this whole what's going on in the Pacific is that in fact you also have correlation of the Q or the attenuation with spreading rate. If you do a cross section here, I can't remember the latitude of this. I think it was minus 20 degrees south. 20 degrees south. Do a correlation of the Q, and this is an older model, but it would still hold, with the spreading, or actually with the age of the plate, you can see an asymmetry between what goes on the east side and what goes on the west side, which I wanted to show this to tie into the discussion yesterday about the cooling plate model, because there's clearly from data, there is something going on in the Central Pacific that is preventing, that is keeping up the heat, right, for longer distances, or on the western side of the Pacific than on the eastern side. And this is a very large-scale view, but if you look at the results by Forsyth on near the East Pacific Rise, he has same kind of asymmetry at a much more local scale. Okay, so this ties in into, okay, trying to tie in the elastic velocity with the anisotropy and the attenuation. We've seen this picture already. This is this Pacific anisotropy anomaly, which has much stronger SH than SV in the central of the Pacific. And again, we can sort of compare this to what we see in attenuation, where this zone of horizontal shear is quite well corresponds with the zone where you sort of have to move from the sort of superplume, vertical superplume towards the ridges. So that may be one reason why we have this anisotropy. And in fact, it also sort of can be compared to another type of anisotropic map, and this is from already quite old paper by Jean-Paul Montagnier and Toshiro, showing that in the Central Pacific, the direction of the azimuthal anisotropy, which was very much perpendicular to the X-Pacific rise right on the ridge, kind of gets a little messed up. So you have the impression that you have two types of flows mixing up there in the Central Pacific, and most possibly something coming from directly above the superplume, interacting with the plate-related motion from the ridge. Here,
yeah.
This is surface waves. I would guess around 150 seconds.
Yes.
This isn't very deep. This is 200 to 300 kilometers. Okay, and this is under Africa. Maybe I don't want to bore you with that. We've already discussed, Sohn talked about...
Here again,
You want to see this? Yeah, the African one. Okay, if you want to see it, that's fine. So the African one looks similar. Again, you have something in the lower mantle, which is very broad here at the base. And the work by Helmberger and his collaborators indicates that these boundaries here can be very, very sharp. It seems to rise up there. I'm not sure about what it does here. But then you can pick it up in the attenuation again, and until the base of the lithosphere, where again you have some connections to the ridges on both sides. This is the section MN here in southern Africa. And then you can do the same further north and see the connection to the ridge to the west. But okay, so the other thing is the superplume looks like a big thing here that narrows down maybe 500 to 1,000 kilometers about above the core mantle boundary. But it, depending on which way you view it, it actually has several branches. So it could be a collection of smaller scale features that we can't resolve just as well.
I get the impression that the shape and size of this is quite different from the things we saw yesterday on record.
Well, because it's a different cross-section. If I were to show you this cross-section, which is the standard one, you would see a tilted plume. I can show it to you later if you want. But it's not, the model is not that much different from anybody else's. Okay, we've discussed anisotropy again, and the possibility of presence of anisotropy at Lindy double prime that would have a strong degree zero, which would indicate a preference of horizontal shear at the base of the mantle. I'll pass that. And finally, just mention, this again, this has already been discussed by Thorne, the very intriguing fact that the boundary of the superplume here in African superplume seems to be very sharp, as indicated by these very sharp transition over a very small distance of the travel times of here. I guess this is as diffracted along a profile. In fact, I wanted to just add to this, and I've shown that already last week, is that we've been looking at this also both on this side of in the Indian Ocean, so on the boundary of the superplume here, African superplume, and then also on the edge of the Pacific superplume. And indeed, not only do you see these offsets very much, this is the same as Helmberger has been seeing, but in addition, if you look at short enough periods, you see additional phases coming in the back, which in fact can very, very well be modeled using SEM when you have a strong boundary between a fast and a slow region. You will generate this type of phases, basically triplication phases, related to something really sharp. So this is really intriguing. So conclusion. I think to really image plumes in the sense of these small features, we need more different types of data that we don't have right now. We need a very large aperture array. In particular, I would like one centered in the Pacific Ocean, because that would help us decide what is underneath Hawaii, but also see the relationship of those plumes in the Pacific with the big superplume that we see in the lower mantle. But in terms of global, large-scale tomography, the next step in the S-wave tomography type studies is to combine the anelastic and anisotropic information that should also help constrain the large-scale flow. So this is the type. I would like a Earthscope US array on this scale. That's it. This is an ocean buoy. That's one of these ocean buoys that we're trying to put in the middle of the ocean.
Is this one of these floating things? Or
yes.
A Malay buoy?
No, no. This is one of the big buoys that.
Ocean orbit.
Yes.
Right. So you don't think the Japanese could have enough seismometer up on the Pacific?
No, they didn't have them. They don't have enough. No, and they haven't had them for long enough.
Do you think you would put more seismometers than the Japanese?
Yes.
They give you money.
That's right. I mean, you can always.
Could the Japanese invest a lot of money?
Yes. Well, I'm not saying that it is easy.
Or cheap.
Or cheap. Okay.
So how much is the plume experiment going to be able to do?
Yeah. So the plume experiment, if my understanding is correct, will cover. It's around 500 kilometers, and where's Hawaii? Hawaii. Will be something like that, right? So it will be helpful, certainly.
How deep will it be?
No, this actually.
It will, well. Gosh, you have to ask. You know, they've done the. I'm sure they've done the calculations, but I would say it will again have. Well, it will give you more lateral resolution, definitely. You know, you'll be able to stand back and see whether things are really concentrated. It'll give you the thickness of the conduit. The depth resolution, I think you'll have to go down. Well, if you combine surface waves and body rays, they might be able to go down to, you know, at least transition zone depths. They will be able to do that. But the point is, they will have Hawaii, but they won't have. What I'm interested in is the relation with superplume and the ridge and everything, which is, you know, the next level. Okay. Oops. Okay, so now we have a number of shorter presentations. I think we can squeeze in at least one or two before the break. We had Slava, we had Dave. Dave is ready. You're ready to go. So let's have Dave, and then maybe Slava, and then I think Dave.
Yeah.
You wanted? Oh, okay. Well,
two Daves.
Okay.
Okay.
You will better explain.